you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I always hate to have to start the show with an apology, but it is required. Last week, you may have wondered why there was dead silence at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, and the fault lays at the feet of a goose. A goose flew into the PG&E wires, and indeed, KELW is down for a good few hours, including during my show. So my apologies to any of you who are hoping to hear the show, which was supposed to be about, should you do what you love for your career? But we will try to turn those lemons into lemonade by incorporating that into today's show. I have had the privilege in the last month to have made five presentations at the Commonwealth Club in their Future of Work series, including their kickoff opening address. And what I've tried to do for today's show, a special Labor Day show, first of all, a tip of the hat to all of you laborers out there, whether you are laboring in a blue collar or a white collar or no collar. But I thought it would be a useful Labor Day show to distill the best ideas that came from those five Commonwealth Club presentations this last month. And that's what I'm going to do. And because I'm actually at this, as the time you're listening to this, I'm out of town, so we can't take call-ins. So I figured I would fill the hour with as many of those ideas as I could. Okay. First, and let me give you a little heads up on where we're going to go. So first, I'm going to talk about choosing a career, some non-obvious careers, some ideas about, you know, how to go about choosing a career. Then I'll talk about ahead-of-the-pack job search strategies, kind of advanced job search strategies. Then some thoughts on beating the odds in self-employment. Then how to go about getting promoted or maximizing your chances of getting promoted, or at least laid off, not laid off in these tough times. And finally, the real thorny question that so many of us face, should you do your passion as your career, or should it just be a sideline or a hobby? I also need to make another apology, which is that obviously many of these ideas are that I will present are things that somewhere along the lines in the 24 years I've been doing this show here, I have mentioned before. But think of this as perhaps a good distillation of my best ideas across the most recent few years. And if you've heard something that's repeated and are bored, I do apologize. Okay, regarding choosing a career, something that is really important is having a better sense of what really leads to career contentment. You know, when I first started out as a career counselor, I believed, you know, you follow your passion, you do something cool. But in the end, when I, having had now over 4,000 clients over the last 25 years, it seems to me that what's key, more key to career contentment than a cool career, is a boss who treats you with respect, reasonable pay, reasonable commute, ethical work, nice coworkers, reasonable hours, those kinds of things. And actually, you're more likely to get those things in a non-cool career because there are fewer people vying for such jobs, and therefore bosses, in order to keep you, usually have to treat you with a little more respect. If you're, for example, a performer, they can send you on, you know, cattle call after cattle call after cattle call, pay you a relatively small amount on a project basis, and then you're gone. The other thing that is very, very important in deciding, in ending up getting a career that's great for you, is that even if a career doesn't feel that perfectly suited, it is so often possible to mold the job to fit your strengths. So that, for example, let's say you are somebody who'd rather have more people contact than less writing work. There's often a way to get either the job description changed or to informally, with your coworkers, trade tasks. That can go an awful long way to making you happy in your career, sometimes much more than choosing career A or choose B. In terms of choosing a career itself, we can put too fine a point on it. I encourage people to say, not get too narrow in what they say is what I want. You know, basically, if you're a word person, look for a career that involves a lot of speaking and writing. If you're more of a people person, a lot of people contact. If you're more of an investigator research type, look for a job that's got a lot of that more isolated work, whether it be computer programming or research or whatever. If you're a hands-on, fix-it, build it person, find a job that fits that. And if you're more of an office detail person, find something that fits that. But beyond those six categories, trying to put too fine a point on who you are and what kind of job you're looking for may unnecessarily narrow your options. And you could spend forever going. I know so many clients have come to me, they say they've read all the career books, and they still can't figure out quite what it is, or there's too many things they're interested in. Just, you know, I think those six things are often enough to kind of narrow your focus. And then go look for, you know, one of the great ways to look for the zillions of jobs that are never advertised or careers you've never heard of is simply to go to Indeed.com, which aggregates 5 million job openings, and simply search on your zip code, and you'll see hundreds of jobs that are in your zip code, including many you had never even thought about, and that may give you some career ideas that are under the radar. And being under the radar, especially in these tough times, is very important, because if you're going to just do something that everybody else wants to do, you're going to get 100 applicants for every, for example, environmental job. There's just a zillion applicants for every broadcasting job, for every fashion job. You know, so try to go under the radar, you know, even away from things like doctor, lawyer, teacher, nurse. You know, far better to go under the radar and see what kind of interesting jobs are less well known, whether it be some kind of a nonprofit fundraising database manager or prospect researcher, as one of my clients is, or a somebody who works in as a child life specialist, helping children in who have been or in hospital stays for a long time. There's just lots of under the radar careers you wouldn't have thought of, and that's one of the ways to find them. One of the things that, frankly, for me, I don't know why it dispirits me, but it does a little bit, because there's so many people I know who would love to have careers that aren't very technical. But, and this is something I did say not so long ago, but when I looked at Indeed.com, which is, like I said, 5 million job listings there, they have they post a little survey where they look at the fastest growing search terms on those 5 million jobs, and they're all technical. HTML5 is number one. MongoDB, which is an open source database, number two. iOS, which is mobile operating system, number three. Android, which, of course, is an operating system for mobile phones. Mobile app, number four. Puppet, which is IT automation software, number five. Hadoop, which is a software that does analytics on large data sets. jQuery, which is a library of internet apps subroutines. And then there's something called POS, which is a way to rent hardware for developing and running cloud apps. And then finally, social media. So it really, you know, if you're looking for some kind of insulator against unemployment, you got to get technical. And many of the jobs these days that are just pure technical, they do get offshored. But if you've got that combination of some soft skills, leadership skills, people skills, writing skills, teamwork skills, etc., and some technical skills, you're more likely to find employment and stay employed. Another kind of a filter for your thinking about what kind of career you might want to pursue, we are in an era, in my judgment, and this theme will be repeated later on in the show, we're in an era of moving leftward. We're trying to redistribute more to the society's have-nots. And because all the statistics are suggesting that, especially in the Electoral College, which is what counts, President Obama will get reelected, plus the liberal media, very eager to adopt this kind of redistributive, quote, justice approach, I believe there'll be lots of jobs serving the have-nots. Everything from comprehensive immigration reform, there'll be thousands of people needed, to everybody from people who are going to try to train these illegal immigrants to pass the citizenship exam, you know, in English, to bureaucrats doing the pencil and paperwork, if they're indeed going to send them back for 90 days, which I don't believe they'll ever do, to their home country. There'll be thousands of people needed to deal with that. So, you know, there'll be more programs to help people who are of, quote, underrepresented minorities, in everything from birth to five programs to dropout programs to welfare programs of various sorts. And so, you know, one of the ways you can increase your chances of being employed well would be to serve the have-nots. I really think there'll be a great, great increase in the number of social workers needed, medical social workers, geriatric social workers for old folks who are going to need help. That's a good filter as you are weighing various options. If you want to be kind of going with the tidal wave rather than against it, that's probably not a bad way to go. You know, I will leave to another day the wisdom of, you know, all that redistribution to the have-nots. But that I think it's a pretty, there's no certainty in the world, but it's a pretty darn good bet that that's where we're headed in the next decade in the arc of American history's priorities. Another thought in choosing a career, and this is, it's to be realistic. I think the self-esteem movement may have done too good a job. Yes, I have some clients who were tortured by low self-esteem, but I am amazed at how many people come into my office with quite high self-esteem, whose self-esteem is much higher than their achievement would justify. Now, there some things are hard to just, you know, to really judge, like leadership skills. But even there, sometimes these people think they have good leadership skills, and there's just something in their intelligence, in their amount of their circumspection, their ability to handle complex abstractions, the ability to seem to inspire, that just ain't there. But more tangibly, I was a quite successful professional pianist in my teenage years in New York City, and so I feel like I'm in a pretty good position to judge people's musical talent. And I can't tell you how many people who came in are deliberating whether they want to be a musician, you know, whether they should pursue music as their career, and I ask them to sing or play for me, and I'm shocked at how bad they are. And so one of the things I'm going to invite you to do in thinking about choosing a career is try to be realistic. And one of the ways you can be realistic, because it's hard to know yourself, is to talk to people with the power to pay you to do the thing you want to do. If you would like a leadership job, talk to some people who have worked with you who might be able to hire you in that, and ask, beg for their honest feedback. Honesty is, you know, unfortunately in too short supply in America these days, but ask, beg for honest feedback. Ask them, what do you think is my leadership potential? What do I need to get to do to improve so that I can be a leader? Do you believe that within reasonable effort, within 6 months, a year, 2 years, do you believe I would be literally hireable as a manager, as a director, as a vice president, etc., of a nonprofit, a company, a government agency, etc.? I think that's an important way to get a reality check. Not teachers. Teachers are paid to be positive, and they suffer usually in bad student evaluations when they're negative, or if they're a private, like a music teacher, you know, then you're going to fire them. If that teacher says you don't have the potential, it puts that person's paycheck from you at risk. So what you want to do is talk to people who would be paying you, not whom you're paying, is a great way to get some sense, at least, about how viable you are. You also can use my wonderful website that I love called Chexter.com, which allows you to get anonymous feedback from folks, Chexter.com, and you can ask those kind of questions as well. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, a special Labor Day edition. What I'm trying to do is distill my five Commonwealth Club presentations that I made in the last few weeks to the very best ideas that I presented there, and it's essentially is also a distillation of some of the better ideas that I've shared here on this show over the last few years. We're still in the first of the five segments that I'm going to be doing today here on the show, which is things to think about as you choose your career. I think the last one I want to share around that is be anomalous. You know, if you just you kind of go the predictable paths, you're not going to stand out. And I heard of somebody who was 50 years old who decided to take a job as a camp counselor. So he stuck out like a sore thumb, and a male no less. And so therefore there was a lot of interest in him. He was observed and made a lot of connections with the parents. The parents and also the leadership in the camp. It was a way for him to stand out from the millions of others. Another example. If you are 20, another age-related anomaly, if you're 20-something, you know, working and you have interest in older people, working in an assisted living facility as a manager in the kitchen or whatever it is, can enable you to stand out and perhaps be more employable than you otherwise might be. I know a physicist who works in a nonprofit. There aren't a lot of physicists who work in nonprofits, but it's anomalous. It makes him stand out. There's a cachet. If he's hanging around with a bunch of other physicists, he's just another physicist. But a physicist who's working in the nonprofit world, where most people have sociology and psychology and American studies and ethnic studies and gender studies majors, a physicist has more cachet and enabled him to rise more quickly merely because of a kind of this halo that accrued as a result. Also, myself even. You know, my background was in genetics and physiological psychology. And you know, very few career counselors have that kind of a background. And so I have a kind of a, it's not the only kind of client I work with, but I work with a lot of scientists and a lot of doctors, a lot of college presidents. And I don't think if I had that science background, I would have had the credibility. Yes, my PhD is not in that. It's in educational psychology. But having had a significant science background, again, was an anomaly that made me more hireable. Now, I want to talk a little bit about non-obvious careers. As I said, going under the radar is very important. When I was the contributing editor for careers at U.S. News, part of my job was to pick the careers for the their annual Best Careers issue. And I created a 10 variables that I reviewed hundreds and hundreds of careers and saw which one scored highest overall. And the one that scored highest overall, and of course, the right career for one person is the wrong career for other people, but the one career that scored highest overall was optometrist. Six-figure income, job market schedule, planning to grow because of the aging population, high success rate. When you go to the optometrist, chances are you're going to walk out with better vision, not pain, and there are regular hours, reasonable prestige, as I said. So optometry is, if you are medically oriented or you like the idea of one-on-one but are not a high-stress-oriented person, it's a great career. If you haven't gone to college yet, I know most of the listeners to the show have long finished school, but for your sons or grandchildren who are adults, there are 6-year combined bachelor's and optometry degree programs. And if you have a degree, it's only a 4-year degree to be an optometrist, which is a lot less than, say, for example, to be a physician, which is often 10 years. I think optometry is a wonderful career, period. Another non-obvious career area, and that is serving the ever very fast growing Muslim population in this country. So the most vivid example is that Muslim women will not disrobe for a medical exam in front of a male doctor or a nurse or anybody else. So if you are already Farsi or Arabic speaking, and are looking to get into a health career, you will probably find yourself welcomed in open arms in the Kaiser Permanentes and other healthcare entities of the future. And I do believe, by the way, that Kaiser will be the big winner under Obamacare. So that's, kind of an under-the-radar thing. But everything that's Muslim is going to be ever-growing because their immigration rate and, most importantly, their birth rate is very, very high. Muslims and Latinos have the highest birth rate in America. And so, for example, just simply marketing to Muslim tastes, halal food, there are very strict guidelines in terms of what they're allowed to eat and not, very strict restrictions on how much sensuality or sexuality can be shown in advertisements, etc. So being a specialist in even something you wouldn't think was going to be particularly Muslim specific, but Muslim sensitive marketing will be no doubt a growing field. Everything related to things Islam and Muslim. We've already heard for decades about the growing Latino population. And, of course, there's the tremendous amount of businesses that are nonprofits working for them. But Muslims is really one of the fastest growing. And, of course, in the nonprofit and the governmental sector, whether it be Farsi or Arabic-speaking social workers or in the criminal justice system, this is a growth area. And the Bay Area is maybe the most welcoming of things and people, Muslim, of anywhere in the United States. And so that trend is likely to be expected to continue. Another example of under-the-radar careers, bilingual social workers, of course, as I said earlier. And I mentioned there'll be a tremendous need for bureaucrats to accommodate the 11 or 12 or 13 million, depending upon which study you believe, illegals, immigrants here who are going to be eligible for comprehensive immigration reform. Auditors. And this, again, doesn't take a genius to have predicted. President Obama says that when he gets reelected, he wants to have a large increase in the IRS budget so that there can be more audits and therefore more taxes collected. So being an auditor for the federal government, or an auditor for corporations, because most of the audits or many of the audits are of corporations, and so corporations are going to have to hire many more audits, not just for taxation purposes, but in general because of all the financial malfeasance that has come to light recently. Dodd-Frank has created an enormous, let's just say, certainly there's a lot of hiring going on for auditors and accountants, just as there was when Sarbanes-Oxley, the previous phalanx of new rules and regulations, were passed a few years ago. So if you are a number-oriented person, auditor is great. I'm trying to come up with careers here that represent the full panoply of kinds of interest among folks. let me, I can't help it. We live in a science world, so I got to give a couple more science ones. You know, it seems like every time I read the newspaper, there is some challenge that we're facing in the Middle East. You know, it was a few weeks ago, it was when President Assad of Syria threatened that if any outside country dared to meddle in Syrian affairs, he will not hesitate to use biochemical weapons against them. So, you know, we have long been hearing about terrorism of the more traditional variety and even of cyber terrorism. But biochemical terrorism is kind of on the back burner for a while. Again, in terms of under the radar, bioterrorism experts will be no doubt, no matter how much our economies, we're going to have cuts in the size of government, you can be quite sure that there's not going to be a cut in terrorism budgets. And I certainly don't want to make this a Muslim issue, because we all know that there is homegrown terrorism going on here. The people that shot up the Sikh temple, person who shot the Sikh temple, Virginia Commonwealth or Virginia Tech shooters, these have nothing to do with Muslim extremism. And there are many disgruntled people, and especially in this terrible, terribly difficult economy, you're going to have more and more people who, when they get fired, are furious at their boss and feel unjustly and are terrified of being, you know, eating cat food for the rest of their lives. They will go in and then shoot up their workplace. So there will be all kinds of terrorism prevention jobs, whether it be from the literal policing to the biochemical predictions, and of course cyber terrorism as well is a great risk. There is no question there's going to be growth there. We are seeing tremendous progress in genomics. Right now, the famed $1,000 whole genome is very close to occurring. And once we are starting to see it's one thing to know all your genome and what your predispositions are in terms of cancer or whatever, but we're going to be in the next 5 or 10 years starting to know how to address those as, you know, preventions or cures. So certainly being in the genomics field is a great field to be in. And finally, I want you to, we are not shrinking government. Government is, if we look at the chart over the last 30, 50 years, government is growing, 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 growing. And when government says you will do something, we have to do it. So every company or every individual, when they say this is the new law, every other priority goes to the side. The company says, oh, there's this new law, we have to deal with this. So I urge you to read the newspaper, whether online or, you know, or you know, read the New York Times, read the San Francisco Chronicle, read the Wall Street Journal, read The Economist, and look for all the new jobs, new laws that get passed. We've mentioned Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, the immigration law, and there's less obvious examples. When North Carolina passed a law that said that every kid must take earth science, there was an earth science teacher who saw that as an entrepreneurial opportunity. She said, well, if every kid's going to have to take earth science, it means that every science teacher is going to need to know how to teach earth science, and not all of the teachers had. So she wrote a proposal to the North Carolina Department of Education and said, I would like to go and develop a training program for training all the state's teachers in earth science. She got a huge government grant, and that's how she made her living. So I encourage you to please look carefully at the news for new laws, and ask yourself what kind of an opportunity could that create for you as an employer or working for somebody else. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko, a special Labor Day edition. And what I'm doing is I'm distilling the 5 presentations I made at the Commonwealth Club last month and giving you kind of the best of the ideas. And I want to move now we spent the first part of the show talking about various ideas on how to choose a career. Now I want to talk about landing the job. I think these are fairly advanced strategies, which are certainly going to be needed, because in my 26 years as a career counselor, these last few years have increasingly been the most difficult ever for my job seekers. The same kind of candidate who 8 years ago would have landed a job in a month or two is now taking a year and sometimes more, even despite these advanced strategies. But these are the strategies that are working the best. I guess I'll make a little side note. You know, one of the people who always ask, and they've called into the show even and asked, why is this recovery so jobless? Well, ironically, it's being caused by the United States being among the kindest nations in the world. It helps the highest percentage of its have-nots to try to do better, but they're putting it mainly on the backs of employers. everything from Obamacare most recently to paid family leave, which is the law of the land in California, workers' compensation, disability, Social Security, payroll taxes, rights of wrongful termination, lawsuits, etc. The cost of hiring an American is enormous. So even if the demand for orders for a company is increased, they say, I'm going to do anything other than hire. I'm going to automate where I can, which is what so many industries have done. They, for example, the appraisal industry used to hire hundreds of appraisers to go out into the field. Now they use automated computer-based appraisals for as much as possible. So it's a very, very tough job market. And, you know, too many of the jobs that even exist are part-time and temp if they're not out and out offshored. So to land those few jobs, you need to be really exceptional. I mean, the stars are going to get jobs no matter what. They could just submit a plain old resume and cover letter, they'll get a job. But the average person is not going to be able to do that. In some ways, you have to be beloved. It's almost an irrational decision for an employer to hire somebody who's just good, because he or she could do a nationwide search and get somebody amazing, probably for less money than they're even willing to pay currently. So in some ways, they have to love you. They have to feel an emotional connection to you. And one of the best, you can't get that through LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. No matter how clever you are or whatever, it doesn't create love. It may create, you know, a feeling, oh, that was clever, or I'll meet with you, I'll have coffee. But it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go and feel so good about you that they're going to hire you because of that. To me, the phrase I've been using again and again lately with my clients is coffee, not the cloud. Getting together for coffees and drinks or dinner or a hike or whatever is so much more likely to create that deep connection. And you must, in my judgment, and frankly, I think women as a group are better on this than men. Men are too willing to spend time talking about things that don't create deep connection. They'll talk about technology. They'll talk about sports. They'll talk about politics. That's not going to create deep connection. That's not as likely to create deep connection enough to make somebody hire you. Women are more likely to talk about aging, about their babies, about their relationships, about their insecurities, about their hopes, about their miserable husbands. Those are the things that are more likely to build bonds. So I encourage people of both genders to try to find common ground around some emotionally charged issue for that person. And I'll have to leave for another show. I've already discussed kind of the art of how to do that. It's beyond the scope of this show. But really listening your butt off for what seems that person really seems to care about. Talk less, listen more, and really listen. Listen for changes in the person's affect. If you're asking them how is work, and they say, it's fine, that's very different than how is work, it's fine. Subtle difference, but it's all the difference in the world. And if you heard that difference, then you follow up and say, sounds like maybe things aren't so great. What's going on at work? You may have opened the door for a deeper connection. Really, really important. Okay. Silly. Shallow. It speaks to how shallow we all are. What does matter online, perhaps as much as your resume or your references, is your photo. The photo on LinkedIn or on Facebook, or on Twitter, where you can actually also have a photo in your bio as your background, is very important. You must engage. It must be engaging. I don't care how much you have to practice, how you take 200 photos. Ideally, you want it to look very engaging, and perhaps not just staring at the camera so it's a mugshot, but doing your work. If you are a computer programmer, look engaged working at the computer. If you're a salesperson, show yourself interacting with another person. Something where you're doing, not just standing there clearly as a posed picture. Another job search strategy that has worked really well is what I call the point-by-point cover letter. The point-by-point cover letter simply means, and I'll just dictate a version of it, it's something like, dear, sometimes usually these days with ads you don't even have the name of the person, but to whom it may concern is dear sir or madam, whatever. I was pleased, not delighted, pleased, you don't want to sound over-anxious, pleased to see job number 4365B on Indeed.com because I believe I'm a good fit for the position. Do not say uniquely qualified, that's hype. I believe I'm a good fit for the position. Then you list the first major job requirement listed in the ad, verbatim, and underneath it, you say how you meet the requirement. So job requirement, put that in bold, how I meet that requirement in bold, and for each answer. And then go through each of the major job requirements as listed in the ad and do that. And obviously, if you don't meet most of the requirements, don't waste your time. Because when an employer places an ad, he's expecting, he knows he's going to get dozens or she's going to get hundreds of applicants. And so don't waste your time on that. You're going to burn out your energy applying for jobs you have no chance of getting. So, but if you do meet the requirements, using that point-by-point cover letter, and by the way, you end it by saying, of course, there's much more to me that can be stated in a chart. People say they blank and insert something that people say they like about working with you, that you're always upbeat, that you have your good problem-solving skills, that you're ultimately reliable, whatever it is. And then end the letter by saying, so I hope you'll choose to interview me. I look forward to meeting with you. I particularly am interested in your company or your nonprofit or your government agency because blah, one or two sentences. You don't have to go into great detail at this point. That takes too much time. That point-by-point cover letter can be highly effective. And the final thing I want to talk about with regard to job search strategies is what I call the influencing packet. Everybody for a million years has always talked about sending a thank you letter. That is de rigueur. That is standard. That only gets you into the race. It doesn't make you ahead of the pack. You want to include one or more of these things either as a thank you after the interview or even before. A white paper, which is a 2 to 3 page paper that basically would impress that employer. If you are interested, for example, in marketing iPhone apps, you're going to want to write a 2 page paper that says best ideas for marketing iPhone apps in 2013 and beyond. Something brief. It could even be 1 page of bullets. But that's a great way to show you have the stuff, especially if you don't have a lot of experience on your resume that shows you have the stuff. A white paper can often help compensate. Another example of something that could go in an influencing packet is a proposal. Perhaps you had an interview and you got a sense from the conversation, and interviews should be conversations if possible, not just listening to their questions and being bombarded with those questions. Sometimes that's you have to because there are affirmative action interviews that require that all interviewees get asked the same questions. But if you have some discretion, you make it a conversation, and in the conversation, it may indeed have been revealed that there is a way that your job description could have been revised to better meet the needs of the organization as well as be better suited to your skills. You may want to include into your along with your thank you letter a revised job description for their consideration or a proposal. Let's say they're worried about selling X more widgets in Brazil. You might write a 1-page or 2-page little mini business plan for how you would go about trying to sell their widget in Brazil. Of course, you always need to make those proposals very tentative so that you don't seem like a know-it-all. So you always say, of course, I have limited knowledge of what the company has already done in that regard, and this could be way off, but this perhaps will at least give you a window into the way I think. So that's a very useful technique, the proposal. Very often in certain fields, a portfolio. For example, it's obvious that people who are in graphic arts or whatever might submit a portfolio, but even if you're a manager, the reports you've submitted, the PowerPoint decks of presentations you've made, sending work samples are a very, very valuable way of impressing an employer beyond what can appear in a resume. I love this, my people who are applying for sales positions, and by the way, that is one of the fields that is still growing, sales. And so if you are applying for a sales job, it could not hurt in your thank you letter to include a list of potential individual actual names of people you would contact if you got the job. And you don't give them the complete list. You can end that with saying, here are 10 of those names. I have 40 more. Hire me and I'll share them with you. So those are either, of course, you're not going to put all of those into your influencing packet. But when you're applying for a job, just sending a thank you note is usually not going to do it. You've got to go beyond. It's been said many times that jobs are won and lost after the interview. So I know you want to take a deep breath and you're relieved after the 6 interviews you've gone through or whatever, but really the jobs are won and lost with the kind of things that I've just said. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko, a special Labor Day edition. I am distilling the 5 presentations I made at the Commonwealth Club in the last few weeks, hopefully trying to give you the best of Marty Nemko. And because I am actually out of town as we speak, visiting my mom in New York, but I didn't want to just play an old show. I wanted to give you the best of what I have. Okay, the next of the 5 presentations that I did at the Commonwealth Club was Beating the Odds Against Self-Employment. And I want to share with you what are the best key principles that help you to beat the odds, as well as specific examples. The first general principle is I really believe this profoundly, is that status is the enemy of success. Most of the people to compete in the high-status businesses of biotech, high-tech, solar, etc., is very difficult because the best and brightest minds tend to go there. So you're competing, your competition is very, very rigorous. Whereas, as I've said in the book, A Millionaire Next Door, which summarized the surveying of 750 millionaires, the most common low-risk path to wealth is running what he called, what the author is, I guess his name was Stanley, is called dull normal businesses. And the example I like to use, it's a modern-day one, is what I call Space Maker. These days in this terribly tough economy, many people who are homeowners are thinking of either selling their under-the-water home or somehow finding money. Or instead of moving to a bigger house, they're finding ways to make use of their existing space. Or they've got an aging parent and they'd like the person to move in, but they don't think they have the space. So a space maker is somebody who might, for example, clean out a garage and replace it with shelving, or turn it into a studio apartment, or take an attic and make it useful. Anybody who takes non-usable space and makes it useful is a space maker and capitalizes on this tough economy. It's not a high-status job, but status is the enemy of the contentment. The phrase I like to use is when you're going after these low-status jobs in these low-status fields, for example, mobile home park cleaning or any of these blue-collar jobs, the chances are greater that you're going to be competing with people who have two-digit IQs. You don't want to be competing in the biotech or high-tech or space or law space, you know, intellectual property law or whatever, where you're dealing with the brightest people in the world. Remember that the Bay Area has some of the most intelligent people in the world, and it's pretty darn tough for a mere mortal to compete with those. If you just give up the damn status, you will likely do much better. Another of my most oft-repeated phrases that has been most helpful to my clients, don't innovate, replicate. My favorite example of this was one of my very first clients. He was a dentist, and he was looking for a sideline business. And I had just come from New York, or fairly recently, and and in New York, there's a pizza bite a slice place on every block. But at that point in 1985 here, that was not the case. Well, he loved the idea, and it's now Sibel's Pizza, where he has 17 different stores around the Bay Area. I'm sure he's doing quite well. It may have passed its time now, and now it's overcrowded. That's why you never want to be, you don't want to be the earliest adopter, but you don't want to be the latest adopter either. It's like the last guy to open a cigar store didn't exactly do well. Okay, so, but the notion is to not innovate, to replicate a proven formula. So he went and visited some of the best pizza by the slice places in New York, and he copied what they did. And it became much more likely for him to succeed than if he tried to come up with some breakthrough new idea. Another example, you must keep it simple. And a vivid example of that is, yes, fine, import webcam stands. You know, webcams don't fit very well on, they're not adjustable, they don't work really well, they work on a desk. So webcam stand fine. It's not electrical. It's simple. A webcam? No. It costs millions of dollars to develop a webcam. Keep it really, really simple. Another principle in starting a business that's going to be more likely to help you beat the odds is it's a corollary of it being simple, something clonable, where you make, I don't care if that one outlet, let's say one shoe shine stand, makes only $5,000 or $10,000 a year. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's clonable. Once you've developed a really good system for the shoeshine stand, a great name, like I love Diane Feinschein, if it's got, you know, great locations, you've trained the people well, you've worked out the pricing, you figured out a clever way to do the signage, make it attractive, everything else, then you simply clone it. Even if it made just $5,000 a year, by the time you open 20 shoeshine stands, you're making $100,000 a year. And because it's such a simple business and costs so little to start, there's much less that can go wrong. Clonable businesses, greatest idea. Another corollary of that is you want to start a business that has low startup costs. There are so many of them. That stupid idea that it says it takes money to make money. That's one of those MBA ideas. Yes, if you want to go scalable and go national and you know, these big R&D costs. But if you are still taking a simple, clonable, replicating business, or a service, the startup costs can be extremely low, which are critical because you don't probably have deep pockets, and so you can't afford a big failure. You're going to go broke. So here are some examples of low startup businesses that are ethical and likely to be successful. Financial aid counselor. The cost of college is ridiculous. So just like many people go to accountants to get their make sure that they don't pay too much in their taxes, Similarly, there are financial aid counselors who teach you how to fill out all those financial aid forms so you're getting as much financial aid as possible. Great job. You can do it out of your own home. It's not rocket science. Somebody, you know, with the millions of accountants and bookkeepers, etc., you spend a few months learning the ins and outs of the financial aid rules, and you can have a wonderful career. Families are desperate. Middle-class families are caught in the middle. The poor get a lot of financial aid. The rich don't need it. But the middle class is paying a fortune and would be glad to pay you $500 or $1,000 to help them save, could be $5,000 or $10,000 or $15,000 on their financial aid. Another example. Small businesses are these days are... And appropriately, I think, in their attempts to market, they're creating little videos. Videos to, you know, whether they be plumbers or tutors or whatever. And so there's really cool, wonderful graphic software that create great graphics and great videos and something called video scribing, which is my favorite. It's like if I were giving this talk right now and it was on a YouTube video, there could be a whiteboard in the back that was actually having cartoons drawn in real time to visually represent what I was saying. And studies have shown that that increases the retention and focus of the viewer enormously. So if you're somebody who is video-ish and graphic-oriented, being a small business video maker who integrates those cool new pieces of software could be really find himself with him or her with a great job, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. A relationship ad writer. We still, no matter how tough the times are, many people are lonely. They want to hook up, and they're using it. If we're busy, you want to use Match.com or JDate or whatever, Christian Singles, to meet somebody. But most people write a crappy ad. They don't take good pictures. Being a relationship ad writer costs you very little to start the business, but it could be of great value to you, to your potential clients. Healthcare advocate. You know, whatever, whether you love Obamacare or you dislike it, nobody could say it's simple. It's going to be very complicated. And it's going to, especially if you've been diagnosed with a serious disease, cancer or diabetes or heart condition or whatever, you really need somebody to help you wend your way through this, the system. And so healthcare advocates don't need a lot of money to start the business. High demand, high need, high emotional reward, being a healthcare advocate. Another example is a career like a coach like I am. But I don't think you can be a generalist anymore. I think to make it in this market, you need to be a specialist, whether it be like I have kind of a specialty. I have, MDs are a very common niche for me. I have a lot of doctor clients and lawyers. But you could specialize in people with Asperger's syndrome or retirees or former sex workers. It doesn't matter. But having a niche where you're the go-to guy or the go-to girl, that's a great little coaching career, and again, requires very little in the way of startup costs. Also, you want a business that's high profit margin. I've talked about this many times, of course. The espresso cart, a cup of coffee costs 5 or 10 cents to make, and you sell it for $3. That's an amazing profit margin. Eyeglass frames, they're just plastic or metal. They're cheap pot metal, and they cost, from imported from China, they cost 10, 20 cents a piece, and yet they're sold wholesale for $30 or $40. Gelato. What is it? It's cream, sugar, and water. A little scoop or two that you charge $3 costs you 20 cents. Cosmetics. You know, they tend to the lipsticks and the cosmetics that women pay 5 and 10. I guess there's some men now who use cosmetics. Pay $10 or $15 for that lipstick costs pennies. All it is, lipstick is just wax and colorant. My sister found that out. She bought the lipsticks for 65 cents and similar items for that kind of price and sold them out of her own little cute little store called Let's Make Up, and has gotten quite wealthy. And before she could afford to rent her own store, she simply sublet for a very small amount of money some window frontage in a high-end beauty salon. So high margin is obviously a great way to improve your chances. Low risk in trends. You don't want something, you know, there are people who try to come up with some new thing or sell some new thing, you know. So, for example, used diesel truck parts, yes. Harem pants, no. Needing to be frugal, very important. Start, if at all possible, working at home, not a storefront where the meter is ticking all the time. And certainly don't do like I was once asked to be a consultant to a group of investors who were thinking of investing in this online business, and the sales presentation occurred at Bishop Ranch, which is a very, very high-end office park with fountains and atriums and all this other stuff. And then we walk in, and every one of the workers had air-on chairs. I told them, you know what, that clearly they're interested in show and prestige. They're not interested in being cost effective. You don't want to do that. You want to be frugal. You want to always think about, for example, if you do need to rent space, how could you get it free? Do you have a friend who has an office that you could use part-time when he's not there? Do you, not buy a new model, but something that's recycled and old? Could you, instead of hiring somebody, hire an intern? Just make sure you're ethical and don't make the intern just do your scut work. Provide the mentorship that's really required in an internship, but you can save a lot of money. Hire people on an as-needed basis. Most employers don't need a particular employee 52 weeks a year. If you really only need them for a project, hire them for the project. Labor is one of the highest costs. And I know from a position of the worker, I know a worker wants a full-time job with benefits. I don't blame you at all. But from an employer standpoint, if you're a small business starting out, if you're hiring somebody full-time with benefits, it's costing you a fortune, and you rarely do need, you may not need anybody full-time with benefits. Just ask yourself three times whether you really need a project worker or nobody. All right. Listening to Work with Marty Nemco, this is a special Labor Day edition of the show. And what I'm doing is distilling the best ideas from my five Commonwealth Club presentations that I gave in the last few weeks. This next one is about, now we're assuming you're on the job, how to get promoted or at least not laid off in these tough times. Number one, it's going to seem like an odd thing to begin with, but it's actually the most central, which is to embrace work. These days, unfortunately, you know, and I don't mean to, I'm fully aware of the benefits of work-life balance, but I'm seeing the people who are getting laid off are the people who just do the minimum. They come in on time, they leave on time. The people who stay and get hired are not just working smart, they are working longer. They're coming in a bit early, they stay a little late. They don't just come up with ideas. Anybody can come up with ideas. These days where the world is long on ideas, the internet has a million of them, all that does is gives your boss more work or makes him feel like he's got to say or her say, I'm sorry, we can't do that. The thing you want to do is you want to make your boss's life easier. You need to say something like, how can I make your life easier? The other way to deal with embracing work is sometimes you may intellectually embrace work, but you may not feel, you just find yourself as being a procrastinator. I've done tons of shows about about how to conquer procrastination, but for today, the most potent thing is the most obvious. It's been said 10,000 times, but it's true. When you're overwhelmed at the enormity of a task, break it into baby steps. If you don't know how to break it into baby steps, ask somebody who can. That ends up being the very simplest. Also, picture the benefits. Realize how much better you'll feel about yourself, how much better your employment situation, how much more productive you'll be if you're not a procrastinator. Think back on how much procrastination has hurt you in your life. That may be helpful. Next, you've got to, early on when you're onboarding in a new job, you've got to learn the workplace culture, and it's not as obvious as you might think. For example, I hosted a show on KGO for a couple of years, and my way is to normally ask a lot of questions. It shows enthusiasm, it shows interest, and I can get my questions answered so I don't screw up later. But I found out the hard way that, not too hard way, but I found out that asking more than a very few questions is not consistent with KGO's corporate culture. You're viewed as high maintenance. Well, that's not going to appear in the employee handbook. You want to find out all the things that aren't in the employee handbook that are critical. And so when you are hired, or even when you've been offered the job and haven't accepted it yet, I encourage you to hang out in the break room, talk with people, or even in the interview process, ask something like, what should I know about the workplace culture that wouldn't appear in the employee handbook? And that can give you a sense of whether it's the right place for you or not. And if you've already been hired, can certainly give you a heads up on what it's going to take for you to do to succeed. So you're not shaking your head and wondering why you either got laid off or aren't doing well. Find out about the workplace culture. Also important, every workplace, every worker in my mind should have a board of advisors, even if you're an admin. It can be people who work in your workplace, people in your profession out of your workplace, simply friends you respect. I formed one about 8 months ago where I thought of the 10 human beings on the planet who I most respected as being intelligent, ethical, good in a group, not dominating, but not too quiet either. And I invited them to be on my board of advisors. And we meet now every month by teleconference. There's a great free teleconferencing software called Rondee, R-O-N-D-E-E. And each of us takes a few minutes in the hot seat, and we share our problem that we're facing, and we get the group's input. It's amazing how high quality the input is, because, again, these are the people, my dream team of folks. I got this great board of advisors. So I think that is also a really important key to career success once you're on the job, or even if you're not. I know that it's tempting to dabble. We all like to dabble. It's fun to learn a little bit about a lot of things. But unfortunately, especially in these unprecedentedly difficult times in the job market, you really do need to become the go-to guy or go-to girl in something. Sure, after you've done that, there's plenty of time for other things. But there's so many of my clients have failed in their career and are failing now because they're generalists. They have a little bit of expertise in this, a little expertise in that, but they really don't. They aren't the go-to guy or go-to girl in anything. So I do encourage you to cling to find something to become expert in. And alas, unless you're brilliant, unless it's a very simple field, it can take years to become the go-to guy or girl. But ultimately, not only will that help your employability, but you'll feel better about yourself. So many people suffer from the imposter syndrome, where they feel like they're just BSing their way through career, and that doesn't feel good. Next. Communication. You know, I used to suffer from a great weakness, which is I thought I would prove how smart I was by finding holes in people's arguments. In the end, yeah, they may have thought I was smart, but they also hated me. And I certainly lost some friends and colleagues in work situations, consulting gigs. It's very important where possible. Human beings are very frail. You've got to, in general, if at all possible, preserve people's self-esteem, try to make as many supportive statements as possible. Most of you may know this. It's just something that I had to learn, but it is critical. Also, the traffic light rule. Of course, in this radio show, because this is a show in which I'm out of town, I can't stop talking. But normally the best rule is to use the traffic light rule, which is during the first 30 seconds of an utterance, your light is green. People are listening. They're not thinking you're a blowhard. During the second 30 seconds of an utterance, your light is yellow. They're beginning to think, oh, is this a chatty Cathy? After 60 seconds, you better shut up unless you're telling a particularly fascinating anecdote. Following a traffic light rule is really important. Many people who don't have a good sense of time should practice with a timer in front of them to get a sense of what 30 and 60 seconds is. Another little simple tip is to sit in the what I call the focus spot. In every meeting, the boss who's running the meeting tends to focus his or her eyes in one place, usually a little to the left or a little to the right of center. Notice where that boss focuses his or her eyes, and if it's a standing meeting that occurs every week or every month or whatever, try to sit in that spot because your boss will then see your smiling face, your nods of agreement, and there's more connection possible, and connection is very, very important. This is going to sound pontificating, but it is crucial. I really believe that in these tough times, there's ever greater temptation to be unethical in the workplace. Please, for yourself, for cosmic justice, for karma, for avoiding getting fired, make ethics primary. Every decision you make should be based on what's going to create the most good for the company, the nonprofit, for society, for yourself. Put your own selfish goals. I can't say you subvert them, but please don't let them subvert what is the ethical, logical good. Most people do know what the ethical thing to do is. They either don't think about it and they just do what's expedient. I would encourage you to make that primary. Do get feedback. We are scared of feedback. It's yucky to get feedback because you're scared of what they're going to say. It's important to ask for honest feedback. And there's a tendency for people not to be honest, so you have to beg for honest feedback. Really critical. Better to find out early than to find out later and get fired. This seems like an obvious one, but it's so true. Millions and millions and millions of Americans suffer terribly in their career because of a substance abuse problem, whether it be alcohol or marijuana or something stronger. I want you to ask yourself if you do have a problem, and if you don't know, most people who have a substance problem don't know. Ask the people who you love and respect, do you have a substance problem? If so, substance abuse problem, deal with it, because you could be doing everything else right, and that can kill your career. And finally, if you're in a hiring position, do hire slow and fire fast. It is very, very difficult to get rid of somebody in especially a permanent employee in today's America. And so take the time to hire slowly. Don't place an ad. Ask all the people you know and respect for recommendations of people to interview, and then make the interviews filled with simulations. Then get a long list of references, maybe 10, of your finalist candidate before hiring that person. Call that person's employer, email that person after hours, and ask for candid feedback saying, I'm hiring for a very important position. If you think this person is excellent, email me or phone me back. If you think this person is not excellent for this position, don't. Unless you get six or more yeses, it's probably the wrong person. Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, a special Labor Day edition of the show in which I'm distilling my five presentations that I made last month at the Commonwealth Club. Hopefully it's kind of a best of the Marty Nemco. And because I'm out of town, I can't take calls. So I'm just trying to fill the hour with as many good ideas as I can. The last topic I want to talk with you about is this thorny question so many people face, which is, should you do your passion as a career? Well, the major reason to do it is many, if not most people, are happier living in poverty, but still as long as they get a chance to spend their time on their passion. The major con, of course, is that you're more likely to find career contentment, not to mention economic self-sufficiency, in a not cool career because the employers are more desperate to keep you and doing your passion as a sideline or hobby. But what about you? Should you be pursuing your passion as your career? Here are five questions that can help you figure it out. There's no right or wrong answer, but number one, if you pursued your passion as a sideline or hobby instead of as your main career, would you be satisfied or dissatisfied? If you pursued something other than your passion as your main career, what would you likely earn per year? Would you earn over $100,000? That's more likely a reason that you'd want to then do that as your main career. If you'd earn less than $20,000 doing something else otherwise, you might as well pursue your passion. Three, in the past year, how much have you earned from doing that thing you're passionate about? If you've earned, you know, ramen wages, then that's a pretty decent predictor. You're probably not going to do that well in the future. Four, when you've talked with people with the power to pay you to do your passion, have you gotten the sense that at least one person would likely or definitely pay you a good enough annual amount to do what you're passionate about? Or is no one with the power to hire you said they might pay you a good enough annual amount to do what you're passionate about? That can help you. And then finally, looking externally, what percentage of people stably earn at least a working class annual income doing your passion? For example, database programmers would do, certainly true. A lot of them do. Where fiction writers, very few. So, hopefully that helps you gain a little clarity. And that is it. I've tried, I think, hopefully, I feel pretty decent about having crammed in as many good ideas that came from my five Commonwealth Club presentations last month in this hour. Hopefully it was helpful. I'm sorry I couldn't take your calls, but I was out of town. I thought, though, this would be more useful than just playing a best-of show. So this is fresh, at least. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Moore. And until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty has a new book out, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, and 1,000 of his published articles are free on his website. From there, you can also email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com. That's Marty, N-E-M-K-O.com. Join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11, live and in person, for Work with Marty Nemco, here on 91.7 FM, KALW.